Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Maxine Harrison. Born and brought up in Africa, at the age of 17, Maxine spent 6 months in Paris studying and teaching English, and then moved to the UK at 18. She landed a job in the film business as PA to a producer, and her first marriage to a very wealthy entrepreneur, much older than herself, which lasted only a year, and in Maxine's words, but what a year. We'll come on to that later, I'm sure. At 23, Maxine then decided to travel and spent 6 months living in the Caribbean before returning to the UK, working in the music business, firstly in music management and then in publishing and A&R. She married a musician and managed his career for about 5 years, which took her touring around Europe and America. She also ran a production company, producing music for advertising commercials, and then the marriage ended. In brackets, again, Maxine's words, rock and roll, exclamation mark, and once more, Maxine was back on her own. In 1986, and now 32 years old, she spent a year in Cliff Richard's organisation before hidden and long stored up grief took its toll, and illness and alcoholism stopped her in her tracks. A year of treatment, therapy, and hard work followed to get her back on her feet. Maxine married again, and on the birth of her first son, decided that she had to find a way to earn a living and be a mum at the same time. She started her business in 1990, Elysian Holidays, which grew from letting her own and a few other houses on a Greek island to a business that by 2013 let over 150 villas around the globe and winning an award annually from Condé Nast Traveler in the USA as one of the top villa specialists in the world. Maxine then followed one of her other dreams and returned to Africa as a volunteer for a homeopathic charity. She spent a year in Swaziland and then returned to the UK in January 2015 to sell her house and return to Africa. However, the universe had other plans for her, and she found herself buying 3,000 square foot of rundown warehouse with a flat in Rye in the southeast of England. The idea for an holistic centre came to her in a flash whilst looking around the building, and 18 months later, after a major project, the Elysian Centre was launched. After all her years of travelling around the world, Maxine has finally found somewhere she really belongs. Wowza, Maxine. I was reading this because we've met a few times before. I've come and given a talk at the beautiful Elysian Centre, which is where we are now doing the interview. And I knew a bit about the background. I knew about your villa holiday company, and you told me all about that. What I didn't realise is everything had gone before. And I was reading your bio last night and kind of condensing it down into how I was going to introduce you. I thought, oh my God, there's going to be so more than one interview. Cliff Richard's organisation is an interview in its own right, let alone working in the music business. And Jack, what an amazing life you've had. Jeepers creepers.
I have. And the great thing about it is I have absolutely no regrets.
Fantastic.
I look back on it, and there are eras where sometimes I think or I imagine the person that I was, and she's hardly recognisable.
Really?
But that's in a good
Interesting.
Way. Because I think that's all about growth and growing through my life, whether it's, you know, whether it's growing as a result of something joyful or something, an ordeal of some kind, something quite the opposite. But here I am. After all that, I'm still here. That's the thing.
And smiling and looking fabulous. I mean, just
grateful.
Wowza. So born and brought up in Africa. What part of Africa?
I was born in those days Rhodesia,
right,
known as Zimbabwe now.
Yeah.
But left there when I was two and a half, three.
Okay.
And the majority of my African upbringing was in Nigeria.
Oh, was
Africa.
It really?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yes. But they were great years. They were great years. I mean, we were there when the Biafran War kicked off, which was also interesting because I had a war experience as a child.
Yeah. Gosh.
And I was very, very conscious of that.
Gosh.
And that was, I can still remember it vividly.
So what was that experience like for you?
It was my first real understanding of conflict, human conflict and hatred. Mm. I'd never come across it because I'd led a really magical life up to then. Magical, you know, barefoot kid in the bush and, you know, Africa. Wow. And wide open spaces and animals and,
wow,
you know, and I had a wonderful family around me as well. So that was a shock. We got caught in a riot once.
Gosh.
A riot. And the other thing that was most interesting too, and I do remember this vividly, is that we were in the middle of a riot. People were being killed around us. The army was sitting in tanks, unable to do anything. We were in a big American car with tinted windows. Myself, my brother in the back, children, my parents in the front, my father driving, and they started to rock the car. We could see, I could see machetes and rocks, and my father said, "Roll down the windows. We have to show them we're white." And I thought, what's he talking about?
Wow.
And then I understood, and we rolled down our windows, and they looked in, and they went, "Okay, it's okay, let them pass." And then I knew, I understood tribal conflict. I understood that, you know, when one talks about racism, you know,
it's not black and white necessarily, is it?
No way, you know, and so many of the problems throughout the world now are to do with tribe.
Yeah.
Religion, obviously, but religion and tribe goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I was 10 years old.
Good grief. What an experience.
That was quite something.
Wow.
Mm. Yep.
Wow. I mean, it's something that I can't get my head around because obviously I was born in peace in the UK. Mm. And most people in the West, not all, but most people in the West of our generation haven't experienced war unless you come from part of Eastern Europe.
Absolutely.
With, you know, the Serbian and Bosnian conflicts, and you haven't really had that kind of experience of war. I mean, obviously I grew up with IRA bombs in London, and I just took it for granted.
As
you know,
it's
you just got on with it. But not real war conflicts as you've experienced. Mm. So for actually from a Western perspective in our generation, it's not something that many people have experienced. And we've been really blessed, actually. We haven't been part of many conflicts, have we? You think of how many wars and conflicts are going on around the world and always are.
Mm.
I feel truly blessed that I'm born in a time where I haven't experienced that up close and personal the way you have. What an amazing experience.
It was extraordinary. It was the other interesting thing about it is I saw how at some times, dreadful times, war times, in certain cultures, how incredibly cheap life is, regarded as just, it can just be done away with, without a second thought.
Yeah.
And interestingly, as I'm talking to you, I realise that one of the major influences that probably had on my life was actually to go totally around the opposite way and give me a sense of how actually incredibly valuable life is.
Mm. Well, yes, I guess when you're faced with the reality of losing it in a brutal fashion rather than as natural life goes, a natural flow of life and death, it makes you, it's like people who have near-death experiences, it makes you value the preciousness of life, doesn't it, in a very, very different way. Because we can get very complacent about being alive.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
And it's only when we face it, either ourselves or somebody close to us faces it, that it brings it into that stark perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely, yes.
Yeah, that it's anything but cheap. It's precious beyond...
Precious. We need to enjoy it every moment.
Yeah, every second. Mm. Live every second,
we'll
so it's your last.
It, yeah. Which I guess I have, haven't I?
Well, you packed a fair amount into the years, Maxine. Yeah, let's be honest.
My sons say to me, quite often my sons say to me, well, and my friends, when are you going to write the book? And I'm going, whoa, hang on. I'm not sure. Because I'm not sure how much of that material I'd actually dare put in.
Well, I'm hats off to you. I've been married twice, and I came to the conclusion at the age of 32, after coming out of marriage number two, that I was very happy staying single, thanks very much. So hats off to you for doing it at that time, because you're a braver woman than me.
Oh dear, I know.
So you arrived in Paris at the age of 17. How did that happen? Had you been out of Africa?
I'd been out of Africa.
Right.
So I'd been at school in the UK.
Oh, okay.
And I had just finished my A-levels, and I'd always loved French.
Hmm.
My father had always encouraged me to speak a foreign language. So I'd studied French, I had my French A-level, and the plan had been in place for a long time to go to Paris to study while I was there, hone my French, and then have that as a tool, really, when I came back.
Mm.
I still had, I mean, I did want to be an actress.
My
dream, actually, when I was a child, was to be an actress. And I had a place at RADA at that stage, because I'd already had an interview at RADA.
Right.
I'd done acting all the way through school. And then the tragic thing was that my father died while I was in Paris, very shortly after I went to Paris.
Wow.
And RADA then was out of the window, because we didn't have the money to pay for it at that point.
Okay.
So I went back to Paris after I came home for the funeral, went back to Paris, thought I'm going to continue this because this is what he wanted me to do. I had to finance myself, which is where the teaching English comes in.
Right.
So
right.
I got myself a job teaching English as a foreign language,
never
having done it before. Told a fib about my age again. But anyway, it was that saw me through. And then I came back to the UK.
Wow.
But so, I was living with one of the closest, best friends I've ever had in my life.
Really?
French lady, Inez, who I was at college with when I was doing my A-levels. And she saw me through those times. But that was the first big knock in my life, because I'd had quite a charmed life until that point.
So was that expected with your father?
He'd been ill for a year.
Okay.
But it wasn't expected because he was larger than life. He was an incredibly magnanimous personality. He had hepatitis.
Oh, gosh.
Plus a tropical bug.
Gosh.
And by the time they got him back to the hospital for tropical diseases, they actually gave him a year to live, but they didn't tell us. It's quite an interesting thing, because they felt that if anyone had a chance to pull through, he had, because he had such incredible vitality of life. And in the end, it was flu that got him.
Really?
Because his immune system was so hammered by the hepatitis and by the drugs.
Gosh.
That he died then, yes, and he was 52.
Wow.
I know, far too young.
Far too young.
So that really, spat me out, really. I felt literally at the point that he died that I was at that point, I'd been chewed up and spat out. And it was now, okay, girl, get on with it. You have to sort your life out. So my mother was very, very deeply, deeply affected. Had to go back to work as well at the age of 50, 48, 49, yes. It was...
Goodness me.
Here we go.
Did she stay in Africa?
No. London.
London.
Came back and... we'd come back because he was ill.
Right.
Anyway, my mother had come back. I was at boarding school.
Right.
So she was back in the UK as a result of that. So she lived and worked in London after that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
amazing, isn't it?
Big upheaval.
What with thrown and the resilience of human nature.
Yes, because I had it all mapped out. You know, I was going to be in RADA, got my place. They'd said go off and have a little bit of life experience. I'd go to Paris, get my French sorted, you know, stay there for about a year, come back, slip into RADA. Poof, and then I was going to be this.
Could you not have gone back to it?
Maybe, but life took over, really, at that point, because I think I had this very... It was a really interesting process, because when my father died, I had never had it before, but I got this really powerful sense of having to get out there and do it myself, earning a living.
Yeah.
And it didn't come... It wasn't as if my mother had said to me, right, sorry, darling, you had to get out there and earn your money because I haven't got any. That wasn't the case at all. It came from entirely within. And at just studying, playing around, that was out.
Wow.
I had to go and earn a living and look after myself.
Gosh.
Because nobody else was going to do
it. Yeah.
And maybe that was to do with the reality of my father dying.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, you've taken away the most important person in my life because I hear I worshipped him. I'm going to do this. You think this is going to finish me off? No. I mean, as we'll see a little bit later on.
Yeah.
It did finish me off.
Wow. But so then you landed a job as a PA in the film business, to a producer. That must have been a fascinating time. So when was that, in the 70s?
We're now in the 70s, we are, and he was called Tony Landy, and he was already in his 80s when I started working for him.
How amazing.
American. He was the brother of Elisa Landy, who was a silent movie actress.
Really?
Yeah.
How fascinating.
He was running a production company in Wardour Street. And it was, again, through a friend of mine that I got the job, who was actually a stuntman. And I started working for Tony, and it was great. And he was a gentleman. He was one of those, you know, those types that you hear about, the old school film producers.
Yeah.
Cigar, charming, very polite. He was lovely. He was lovely. So I had a great time with him. And then he died, which was why that came to an end quite suddenly. So there I was again going, oh, now what?
So in between the Caribbean and where you got married.
I did.
To the very wealthy entrepreneur, which lasted a year.
Yes, who was my boss. He was the next job.
He was the next job. So what was the next job?
Well, the next job was, this was somebody who was, he had a helicopter company. He had a charity company. He had lots of different fingers and pies. Very exciting, fun character who swept me off my feet, literally. And we were married on a beach in Hawaii.
As you do.
As you do. And I found myself leading this extraordinary life for about a year. I mean, I had absolutely...
So how old were you then?
I was 21.
And how old was he?
He was 10 years older.
Oh, okay. It was not that much.
Not, but it felt a lot in those days.
Did it?
You know, I think you know, between 21 and 31, it's
maybe.
Quite...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and he was a businessman, and he was, you know, came from this particular family, and, you know, he had a muse house in Knightsbridge, and a house in the country, and a helicopter, and a Porsche, and a, you know, and so, yes, it was very grown-up stuff.
Very,
you know,
grown-up stuff.
With a very grown-up group of people, suddenly I found myself in.
Wow.
But it was not a world that I found easy or comfortable at all.
Mm.
But one of the most useful things about that year, which I have anything to thank him and that year for, was that it taught me about money.
Oh, really?
It taught me, actually, what money is. Money is a means to an end. And you really don't need a lot of it.
Ah, interesting.
You really don't.
Okay.
And I completely, if I had ever had it before, I don't think I did, if I'd ever had an ambition to be rich or to make a great deal of money, it left me.
Did it? How interesting.
Yes, it was quite
surrounded by that wealth. Yeah. It had the opposite.
Yes. Because I saw levels of unhappiness and discomfort and dis-ease.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I just didn't know existed in certainly in the sort of Western elite society. You know,
do you see loneliness within that?
Massive
abundance.
Loneliness. Loneliness and dishonesty and
fear.
Lack of fear.
Fear of losing.
Lack of integrity. Yeah. I mean, just ruthlessness.
Mm.
And just...
How interesting.
I think dishonesty actually was probably the most scary thing, the most, you know, shocking thing. Not to say that I didn't have a lot of fun, because obviously I did, you know, whizzing around the world in a helicopter and, oh, you know, jets and private jets and everything that we did. It was extraordinary. But it was... There was no depth.
Mm. Shallow.
No, very shallow, very little understanding of you know, the joy of life, really.
Of
simplicity.
The simplicity. Yeah, watching a sunset, smelling a rose as it just blooms.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Everything that was enjoyable or fun was linked to money. It had to be the Monaco Grand Prix, or it had to be, you know, a big party with lots and lots of expensive entertainment and food. You know, there was no simplicity.
Mm.
And it taught me a big lesson, and I have never had an ambition for money.
How interesting.
Never. Never.
Because you can't buy happiness.
No, you absolutely can't. And that was really, you know, I learnt that firsthand. Really firsthand.
That's a very powerful lesson. So then you were 22, presumably.
And I walked away.
Did you?
From that situation. Yep. I walked away. I walked away from a lawyer telling me that I could have an enormous amount of money if I wanted. And I walked away from that. And what I actually gained out of that, if you like, which was as a result of chap in charge of the sort of financial element of that particular situation, was a way to set myself up again in life, to get on with my life. And that was great. And it wasn't a great deal, but it was enough. Mm. It was enough for me to start my life again, if you like, or continue again. Mm. And it, you know, it was hard. It was very hard in many ways. But I was also happy to leave that particular society. I don't know what the right word is. Particular part of society behind. Mm. And I've never, ever wanted it again.
Interesting. So then you end up in the Caribbean.
Ah, yes.
Whereabouts in the Caribbean?
That was Trinidad.
Trinidad.
I went for a holiday.
Okay.
And because a girlfriend of mine had gone to live in Trinidad, and she'd married a Trinidadian, and I went for carnival.
Ah.
And I met somebody. I fell in love. I fell in love with a Trinidadian, and who took me to a party on the Saturday night, and I said goodbye to my friends, and I said, oh, see you tomorrow, whatever it was, because he'd said, come on, we're going down the islands, you know, there's a whole crowd of us, you know, bring a swimming costume, let's go. So off we went, and the next time my friend saw me, who I was staying with, was actually on Juve morning, as it's called, which is the very first morning of carnival. In Trinidad, and Juve is the it basically means the open, I open, but it is it's the Caribbean mix of it, or explanation of it. Anyway, so they found me leaning up a tree, up against a lamppost, covered in mud, swamp mud and glitter, carrying a tree.
Of course they did.
Taking a rest.
Why wouldn't they?
I never forget, because Debbie, my girlfriend, came up to me and she kind of looked at me and she went, Max, is that you? And I said, oh, hi, Debbie. She said, where have you been? You left on Saturday and it's Monday morning. And I said, oh, you know, carnival. And that was it, you know. And then I jumped up, as they call it, for the next 48 hours. Collapsed on a beach on the Wednesday morning. And came back to the UK, let my cottage, gave my dog to my mum, locked the car in the garage, and went straight back.
Did you?
Yes, yes.
For 6 months?
Yes. Yeah. And it was just...
Did you work, or did you have six
no,
months of play?
No, I couldn't work. It was 6 months of play, basically.
Oh, fantastic.
Luckily, I couldn't, I couldn't work. But it was actually my time of getting over, I think.
Mm.
The previous few years that had been tough, or starting to get over it. It was just breathing out and going, okay, let's just
reassess.
Yeah, it kind of took a break, really.
That's and it was a nice place to do it.
It was wonderful.
So then you came back to the UK.
Came back to the UK.
What brought that party to an end?
Well, that was really interesting because the chap that I was with there, who, you know, is still a very good friend, basically wanted to get married.
Okay.
And as much as I love Trinidad, and I still have some fantastic Trinidadian friends from that time, I realised that if I did that, I would never leave.
Mm.
Never be able to leave. Island fever, you know, and if you marry into that kind of society, it's rare that you go anywhere else. Right. Particularly in those days. We're talking about a long time ago. Long time. It's changed now. It's changed a lot. But Trinidadian society was very conservative, very traditional. And, you know, you marry your man, you stay. You know? You don't go nowhere. So, and I just think, yes, I have this free spirit. And it's very, I've never been able to clip my wings. it's, and I admit that freely.
Why try?
Know? Why try? I know, why try?
Yes, be here you are.
I know, but I think, you know, I look back and I think, is it because people have tried to clip my wings? Is that why I've, you know, taken flight? And I think it probably is, if I'm really honest. And some people could say that maybe that's very selfish, you know, but I...
Really? I think it would be selfish not to be who you are, because then you're not living authentically.
I think so.
And then people don't get the best of you. To me, that's being selfish.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, first unto yourself be true.
Yeah.
And if we don't live by that, then people are getting a watered-down version of us, which is not fair.
No.
Yeah. I think we all have to be true to ourselves.
And I think, you know, I'm sure you know people who have become ill as a result.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally, in all sorts of ways of being, allowing themselves to be suppressed and oppressed.
Yeah.
So, yes, I...
Good for you.
Fantastic. Never really let anybody completely clip my wings.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Beautiful butterflies should be flying free at all times. So then... Yeah. Coming back to the UK, in the music business.
Yes.
Firstly, working in music management and then publishing an A&R, was that in what capacity? Was that back into kind of PA work? Was that not PA work? What?
I was working for a rock and roll manager.
Right.
As a PA.
Okay.
So that's how I got involved in that.
Fantastic.
And that's how I met my second husband.
Right. Who was a musician.
He was a musician. And that led to some years deeply involved, I mean deeply immersed in the music business, which was...
Fascinating.
It was fascinating. It was a very hard place for a woman in those days.
Yeah, I bet
it
was.
Very hard place. And it was tricky. Very tricky. I mean, I loved it. Loved it, so much of it. But also it had a very detrimental effect on my life, really, because you lead a life that is not real, really. Mm. You know, you're in recording studios all night long and you walk out and it's, you know, the dawn's just coming up and you go to bed to recover and get some sleep. Mm. And it's, you know, you're constantly running on adrenaline, it was, you know, being manager, acting as manager for my ex-husband was tough. Highly competitive, again, constant pressure, deadlines. And when we were doing music for film and music for commercials, that was a lot of fun because he was someone very well known. So we were able to get access to other well-known musicians. So we won deals or contracts, if you like, music contracts for commercials from big ad agencies because we could get the names to actually perform and produce and sing whatever it was in the commercials. So we had a ball. We used Grace Jones, H. Samuels.
Wow.
We got a big contract with them because we managed to persuade Grace Jones to record a track for them. I mean, it was still all that, you know, craziness.
That was easy. She's an interesting character.
She was very interesting. She was phenomenal.
She still is an interesting character.
Yeah,
wow.
She was so professional. She was fantastic.
Amazing woman.
We took her into the studio.
Amazing woman. I love her.
Yeah.
Wow.
So those were, yeah, they were interesting years.
So how long were you married for the second time?
7.5 years.
7.5 years.
Mm, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But it was, I mean, I look back on it and I was quite lucky to survive those years, really, in terms of, you know, mental-wise and health-wise. That's when I started drinking.
Was it? Yeah. While you were still married? Because of the lifestyle?
It was the lifestyle. I started doing drugs. Mm. I did a certain number of amount of drugs. I'd never done that before, but it was all around me.
Yeah.
Nature of the business.
Yeah.
I'm not excusing myself because that's what, you know, that's what we do when we're young. It's like when my kids, I look at my kids and I'm going, oh no. And I think, how can I say anything? All I can say to them, they know my history. All I say to my kids is, listen, I'm not going to tell you not to do anything. All I'm saying is, think about it, be careful, and remember I'm here. And I am your best friend if you ever get into trouble, because I've been there. I've been in big trouble.
Wow.
So so that's amazing. When my life really took a turn for...
So what happened with the marriage after 7.5 years?
That, it kind of disintegrated into drugs and alcohol.
Oh, gosh.
Mm.
Yep.
And an affair.
Right.
And he basically went off with somebody else.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So that was the end of that. And yeah, I then
it would be, really.
Yes. And I spiraled downwards as a result of that. Mm. That really, really knocked me for six.
So was that when you were working in Cliff Richard's organisation?
It was, actually. And working in Cliff's organisation came about because a very great friend of mine was Cliff's publisher. Mm-hmm. And he saw what was happening to me. And he said, look, you know, you've got an expertise that we can really use. There's this job going. I'd like you to come and into Cliff's organisation. And what we're doing is we're looking for new talent. Cliff wants to promote new talent, and he's been a fantastic promoter of new talent over the years. Really brilliant. Mm. So I started to work for the organisation, and it was brilliant because it kept me afloat. I found a place where I felt safe and secure. It was actually, thinking back on it, it's quite funny because I went from the very dark side of the music business, if you like, to the light.
Yeah, I mean, literally one extreme to the other,
isn't it? One extreme to the other.
Yeah.
Where I found myself in a very secure, very comfortable, supportive. He is a fantastic person.
He's an amazing human being,
for.
Isn't he?
Fantastic person.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many people have criticised him, but I couldn't criticise him for anything. He's honest.
He's kept his
integrity
in an incredibly difficult industry. Yeah. The things that he's had thrown at him over the years.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah. And everybody, anybody and everybody who's ever worked with or for Cliff knows what an amazing person he is. And he treats his employees, his colleagues, his band so well.
Mm.
He really is. He's a very, very special person. And, you know, with a recent attack, you know, which is so completely out of order, I remember thinking, this is mad. You know, this is completely mad. There is absolutely no way there's any ground in this. And that was a really helpful time.
So you were there for a year.
Yeah.
And then you were stopped in your tracks.
Then I was stopped in my tracks.
Was it just a disintegration?
No, you know what it was? Writing out a check for my ex-husband.
Oh, really? Yeah, that would do it. How did that come about?
Well, he decided, because I was the one who had a little bit of money. I had a little bit of money left over from actually tied up in property from my first husband,
right,
who had actually helped me start my life again,
right,
which was basically somewhere to live. And I had very stupidly sold that, turned that into cash, which I had spent on my second husband, really, and his career, poured it into that, and we'd made a little bit of money. But I still had a little bit over. And I'd kept that back, which I'd put into buying a house with my mother. And he went for me. So it doesn't always happen that way around. You
absolutely
know, it's not.
Not
always that way around. He went for me.
Absolutely.
And in the end, it was such an it was very, very nasty. It was very unpleasant. And in the end, I just wrote out a check. I fought and fought and fought. And it was on writing out the check, actually. It was literally 2 weeks after that. I had a breakdown.
Hmm.
And I woke up one morning. I'd been drinking very heavily for some time. And I woke up one morning and got out of bed, slumped to the floor and couldn't get off the floor.
Wow.
And thought, oh dear, I think I've hit a brick wall.
Gosh.
But I was incredibly lucky because I rang a friend, a girlfriend, and she had someone staying with her who was lodging in her house in London, who basically said, talked to me on the phone and said, can you get round here? And I somehow managed to get in my car and go round there. And I remember sitting in the garden and talking to him. And he said, you need help. Are you prepared to accept it? And I just said, I was so lucky here, Katie, because I had no pride. I had no ego. There was no, I can do this myself. I was able to recognize that I was dying. Mm. I was dying. You know, my soul was black. I couldn't find me anywhere.
Mm.
And I felt as if I was dying.
Mm.
And I knew that in order to survive, I was going to have to accept help. And so I said, yes, I need help. And he said, okay, I'm going to make a phone call. And he rang a place called Farm Place, which mm-hmm. was one of the first treatment centres in the UK. And I went down there the following day. And I walked in, sat on the sofa in the sort of waiting room, and I just burst into tears. And I thought, I need to be here. I need to be here. I need to be locked away. Not that they do lock you away, but I just felt I recognised the fact that I needed to be removed from normal everyday life.
Mm.
I just couldn't manage anymore. I couldn't keep my head above water.
Wow.
So 3 weeks later, there I was.
Gosh. And you stayed in there, did you?
Oh yeah, it was residential. I was there for 3 months.
Okay. Okay.
And I did what they call, I hit my rock bottom. I mean, I was still fighting slightly when I went in because it was quite funny. The counsellor who saw me, she said, I'm 99% sure you're an alcoholic. And I went, who, me? No, it's everybody else's fault. You know, it's because I've been surrounded by alcoholics and drug addicts and it's the music business and, you know, it's my life and my father died when I was 17 and, you know, it's everybody else's fault. Surely it isn't mine. And I learned very, very quickly, within a matter of days, that was all absolute nonsense. It was me. I had to sort this out.
There's something liberating, isn't there, about the realization. It's liberating and scary in equal measure about the realization we have absolute control over our lives.
Mm.
It's completely dependent on the choices that we make. Mm. We can make any choice we want as long as we're prepared to accept the consequences. Mm. And there's something liberating about that, but there's also something really scary because you can no longer blame anybody
Absolutely.
Or anything.
Absolutely.
And I kind of had at a similar age, I came to a similar realization.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Why do I keep meeting all these shits? What have they all got in common? Oh, that'll be me then. Oops.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe I'm the one who needs to change.
Yeah.
And so there's something amazing about that realization. And then you're literally, for me, there was one road going, fork going in that direction and a fork going in another direction. And I was standing at that point, and I could make a choice of which road I was going to go down.
Mm.
The one of continual blame and victim, or the one of self-realization and coming out of victim. And it's quite a pivotal moment in our lives, isn't it, that realization?
Huge. I had that moment. That moment actually happened to me there, while I was there.
Mm.
I had what they call the rock bottom there. And I found myself in a place where I could either choose, as you say, and it was literally, I mean, it sounds very melodramatic, but it actually was to live or die.
Mm.
Because at the end of the day, addiction, alcoholism is a killer.
Mm.
You know, it's a terminal illness.
Mm.
And you have to understand that. I mean, I had to understand that.
Mm.
You know, that this was serious.
Mm.
You know, this wasn't something that I could just play with. And I was being given a chance. And at that point, I found myself in this place where I was in no man's land.
Mm.
I was hanging, suspended, and it was so uncomfortable. There was no drama. There was nothing happening, you know.
And that can be as addictive as drugs and alcohol is drama.
Well, oh yes. And, you know, for years I had this life which was just flying around, you know, crazy life. And suddenly there was nothing. And the woman who ran Farm Place, she was an amazing woman called Joyce Ditzler. She said to me one day, she begged me, she said, I beg you, Maxine, stay where you are. Do not move. Where you are is somewhere you do not recognize. But it is so important. So I did. And I had this physical experience of filling up. It was like water, liquid, filling up from my feet up all the way through my heart.
Wow.
Until when it reached the top, if you like, wherever the top was, suddenly I could breathe and I was back.
Wow.
And it was, but it was the most amazing experience because I was back. I was back the person I had been, if you like, before my father died, before I started drinking, before it was that person who actually was in touch with herself, the real, again, it sounds very coy, doesn't it? The real me. But it was.
Mm.
It was.
Mm.
So at that age, that was 1987, I really had to start living again.
Mm.
And people talk about it as being like a rebirth, you know, when you recover from particularly something like alcoholism addiction. But it is. It really, really is. I know. I came out of Farm Place and I was sort of walking around London. I saw things I hadn't seen before.
Wow.
You know, it was like my eyes, everything was brighter, you know, lighter. And it was an extraordinary experience.
It is, in a bizarre way, an incredible gift to have an experience like that, isn't it?
It is. It's a fantastic gift.
Because it does give people the opportunity to press the pause button and not keep going along on this treadmill of existence and
self-destruction,
but also even if nothing major happens, and of course if nothing major happens in our lives, people will just carry on merrily until they pop off without actually having the opportunity to press the pause button, stop and appreciate the beauty of life. And it's actually experiences like that that are, when things happen and we have that choice, that you suddenly appreciate everything that's around you and the magnificence of life that's around you. And our whole lives, the whole life experience from that point is completely different.
Absolutely.
So I kind of see trauma as an amazing gift if we are prepared to see it.
I do too, totally. I totally agree with you, because that experience was, I regard myself as lucky to have had that experience. I mean, people, when I've said that to people, they said, what, how could that be lucky? That was terrible. And I said, well, yes, but I had an opportunity through that experience to actually see through and realize, if you like, my own potential.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I had no idea. I had no idea who I was or what my potential was.
Yeah, you could have just jogged along quite merrily.
Yeah.
Kind of almost flatlining, never really stretching yourself to be who you were meant to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it takes away the fear.
Doesn't it?
Because nothing can ever, and I know that, nothing can ever be as frightening ever again as that. There is nothing more frightening you know, than facing your own mortality. At that point in your life, you know, where you're going, whoa, hang on a minute. Huh, I've got a lot more. Mm. There's more time. Surely there's more time. What's going on? You know, and you know, ooh, no.
So amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So after that incredible experience and picking yourself up and having the courage, because it takes an awful lot of courage, which a lot of people very sadly don't have, so that they decide to go down the easier route of self-destruction, incredible amount of courage and inner resilience and strength to come through that, you then married again.
I know.
Are you insane?
I know.
I'm sure. That's a very glib remark.
No, 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 you're right.
How did you meet your third husband?
Well, I had actually met my third husband before I had my breakdown.
Ah.
And he was just about as far, you know, I am a lady of extremes, or I used to be, just about as far away from my musician husband as he could possibly get. He was English, conservative, traditional, fun, handsome, safe, squeaky clean. And after I went through Farm Place and came out the other end, he said, we must get married. And I said, well, hang on. Can we just take time out here? And we took time out for about 6 months. And then I said yes. And I have to admit that a large part of that was the fear. When I say fear is taken away, my fear is taken away now, but I still had the fear then that, ooh, could I go back? You know, is this alcoholism, is it going to come up and stab me in the back again?
Right.
If the going gets tough.
Okay.
Because those were early days. So, you know, for everything that you're told, you will never be frightened again, nothing will ever be as difficult as this, you're still processing that.
Yeah.
And you haven't had a chance. I hadn't had the chance to experience that, put that to the test. So it seemed like a really good idea.
Safety,
security.
Yeah.
Job for life.
Yeah.
You know, everything was fine. I was going to get taken care of. It was going to be okay.
It's very seductive.
Yes. And the thing is that now I know that that marriage was all about having my two sons.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what that was about. Because what my ex-husband gave me, my third husband gave me, was two fantastic sons.
And I've met them and they're adorable.
They are fabulous.
Yeah.
And for that, I am forever grateful to him. And we were together for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, I literally, it had been building up. I had a sense of feeling deeply uncomfortable, deeply, deeply to my core. Mm. And I realized that if I stayed, there was the very large possibility I would get ill again.
Oh.
Because my wings were being very clipped.
Oh.
And also, I could see that if my wings were going to be clipped, that there was a large chance I would get ill again. Because I could so easily fall into depression.
Wow.
Not being allowed, as we were talking earlier, being the person that I could be, or the person that I am. And I left the marriage.
That's a major realization. Mm. To recognize that and then have the courage to do something about it.
And my children were small.
Wow.
Felix was 4.5 and Gabriel was 18 months.
Wowza.
Yes. Yeah. It was a massive, massive decision.
Yeah, huge decision.
But it was so clear to me. And I think the only reason it was clear is because of what I had been through before. Mm. Again, I could see the writing on the wall.
And you knew yourself well enough. Mm-hmm. To recognise the signs as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could feel the cloud.
Feel it.
Because when I was clinically depressed, which is when I was drinking, basically to relieve the depression, you know, I had this black cloud, this grey cloud, and it was coming down again. Mm. It was coming down again. Mm. And I knew I had to do something. And I would be I could have stayed. Of course I could have stayed and fought it. But I would never be any good either to my husband or to my children if I wasn't 100% me.
Mm. That's a lot of courage, hell of a lot of courage.
Well, it also hurt a lot of people as well, you know. Mm. It was hard. That was very, very, very hard. It was a very tough decision.
It might have done, but would you have hurt them more if you'd stayed?
I think so. That was, if you like, my belief and justification if I needed it, but that was my belief. That if I stay, if I get sick again, if I get depressed again, I'm no good to anybody.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a similar thing with my second husband. Mm. I knew I married him for the wrong reasons. And I was desperately unhappy. Mm. And I thought, I'm not going to grow old bones with this man.
Yeah.
If I leave him now, he's at the age to meet the woman he's meant to grow old bones with, because that isn't me. Mm. The longer I leave it, it's like gradually peeling off a sticking plaster, isn't it? Elastoplast after a wound. You know, you just do it bit by bit and it's really painful rather than just going, which is a horrible pain, but it goes really quickly and you get on with it rather than just trying to peel it off and stretching out the agony. Because I knew I would leave him at some point. And the quicker I did it, the quicker he could get on with his life.
And the proof of that, true, also is that my ex-husband did find somebody else.
And so did mine.
And they have two children, and they have a very successful, very happy marriage, and it's great. Mm. So that is exactly what happened. And I'm still single. And I'm on my own. But that's fine
also. But it's fine.
Because
there's nobody clipping your wings.
There's nobody clipping my wings, and I have an awful lot to do. It sounds crazy, but I do. Obviously, the universe has plans for me.
It's amazing. I can't believe we have 2 minutes left. I thought you would need at least one more interview.
Yes.
So you now find yourself in Rye rather than back in Africa.
Yes.
The wonderful Elysian Centre was launched in May,
wasn't it?
2016. So yes. I came along to the launch.
That's right.
So tell us in about 1 minute 30 seconds what it's about.
Right. The Elysian Centre is basically a multidisciplinary health centre, I suppose that's the right word. But it is a place where there are alternative practitioners. What I did was I actually have created somewhere where I can be surrounded by wonderful people. People who...
Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. People who are... I feel comfortable with. They're my tribe, if you like.
Yeah.
I understand and I'm passionate about homeopathy particularly, but all forms of alternative medicine. And I've created somewhere here where I can be part of that. I can support, help, and provide a space for these amazing people who are just changing people's lives in a very safe, really effective way. And it's wonderful.
It is it's a beautiful, beautiful space.
So I feel very lucky. I feel incredibly lucky to have found this.
We've got about 20 years that we've had to miss out, so I think we need to be arranging interview number two. But in two or three words, sum up your life for me and what it's meant for you.
Goodness. Incredibly exciting. And I'm grateful, really grateful for every moment, actually, because every single moment, even the really hard stuff, has been part of growing and learning and somehow building up a little bit of wisdom so that I feel that actually I can cope.
Fantastic. That brilliant way to end. Thank you, Maxine. What I knew it was going to be great fun. This has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.